Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I am Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.
With us today is Gene Kim. Gene is a multiple award-winning CTO, researcher, and author, and has been studying high-performing technology organizations since 1999. Welcome, Gene.
Oh my gosh, so great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. Yeah. So before we get started in sort of more of the meat of the podcast, would you just give our listeners maybe a little introduction to yourself, perhaps maybe like how you got started in the industry?
Well, I started off working for a division of Sun Microsystems in high school. I got picked up at a science fair and I got to do system administration and QA. And this is back when I thought rotating backup tapes was a privilege and an honor. And it was. It just opened the door to what computing was. And so I focused on computer security in undergraduate. I got my graduate studying compilers and high-speed networking. But for the majority of my career, I've really self-identified as an operations person because I think it was my observation when I was at Tripwire for 13 years that it was ops where the saves were made. It was ops where, you know, ops saved us from the terrible developers who wrote terrible code and blew things up in production. There was ops that saved us from, you know, terrible hackers because security people were so ineffective. But in the last 3 years after the Phoenix Project came out, got to say, I now really self-identify as a developer. I learned this functional programming language called Clojure that runs in the JVM. So it's sort of like a untyped F#. And I have never had so much programming in my career. This really brought the joy of coding back into my life. And so it's having a lot of fun coding, and I'm finding myself just sort of detesting a lot of infrastructure work, like configuring YAML files and like trying to figure out how to get cloud costs down, securing things. Like, those are important, but it's like stuff that are just not as fun for me anymore. And so I guess I've never really turned into like one of those developers.
So what are you working on these days? What's a day like for you?
Yeah, on a good month, I get to spend half the time writing, half the time hanging out with the best in the game, of which I have to, you know, consider this exactly like an example of that. And just came out with a book called The Unicorn Project last week. And so it's the Phoenix Project retold, but instead of telling it from the perspective of operations, really telling it from the perspective of life through the eyes of a senior developer slash architect. And it's been one of the funnest things I've worked on, and it's something I'm just really excited about because I think it got to explore some areas that I really want to explore, which is like, what are the invisible structures we need for developers to be productive? You know, how there's this kind of orthogonal problem to DevOps, which is, you know, DevOps was a lot about how do you get code to where it needs to go, which is in production, so that customers get value. There's this other problem, like how do you get data to where it needs to go, which is how do you get data from these older system of record where we can't even afford to copy it out, right? these data warehouses, you know, how do we get it to where it needs to go, which is, I think, in the hands of developers so they can use it in their daily work. And a lot about, like, what do we need from leadership, right? What behaviors do we need to model to, you know, really support a DevOps transformation? And, you know, what things do we really need from leaders to get from here to there?
Yeah, I'll say that I started my career in 1999 as a developer, and more these days I'm finding myself on more of an ops role, more of an ops side, doing a lot more DevOps, making sure that the applications run from first line of code all the way through deployment and being able to pull in telemetry and understand how the applications are going. So when I saw that the Unicorn Project was going to be coming out, I pre-ordered the book. I actually got a couple of copies. I've got an audio book copy that I've been listening to while I work. I will say that I really appreciate you changing the names to protect the innocent. I don't understand, and I don't remember seeing you, but obviously you've been watching my career because I feel like you're describing a lot of the positions and a lot of the projects that I've unfortunately found myself in.
And can you just say like a couple more sentences, like what is it that was kind of observable and what kind of bothered you about that?
It was eerie. The amount of problems and the types of problems that you describe Maxine going through in coming into an organization that either doesn't have source control or is misusing source control or isn't using it to the best of their abilities, doesn't have a plan for deployment into any environment, much less an upper environment.
I love the first third of the book. I mean, I think some people might find it kind of boring. There's no action. I think that's really kind of the point, is you have this kind of incredibly skilled person at the pinnacle of, you know, their career, at the height of their powers. And, you know, she gets exiled into this terrible Phoenix project and she can't do anything, right? can't find the source code repos, doesn't have the license keys, can't run her own tests, can't deploy her own code, and it was for me kind of the mental model of that was like Tom Hanks in the movie Castaway, like can do nothing. And I think for me, what I find very ironic, right, like dramatic irony, is that, you know, often leadership feels like that those developers aren't getting enough done, when in fact, you know, it's more likely that it was like Nokia. You could have 20 times as many developers, but the systems of work are so terrible that it doesn't matter how many developers you have. You know, they're all so unproductive. You know, they're not any, you know, any kind of work is really an illusion, right? So I hope that kind of – that my goal was really kind of convey that in the first third of the book.
Yeah, no, it's so I'm also reading it just like John. I'm about as halfway through as well, and I think you did a fantastic job there. So,
in fact, one of my favorite parts was you know, Maxine running into the rebellion, right? These kind of you know, engineers who are willing to, you know, not do as they're told and self-organize and, you know, try to create these systems to help developers be more productive, and so they're doing all the things that are those things that are so important. In fact, I mean, I think kind of the mental model I love about it is that kind of there's three types of work, right? The first are the features, the apps, right? Anyone can get those funded, right? Because you see the app, right? And then you have the APIs, which are, you know, not as visible, and it's hard to get funding for those. But in my experience, it's almost impossible to get funding for this third one because it's invisible, right? It's the systems that developers use every day. And without kind of daily builds, daily tests, daily deployments, you know, loosely coupled architecture, it really is hard for any one person to get anything done. And so that's trying to make that visible was certainly one of the goals of the book.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting because there's a couple of points, like, again, in the first third, you hear people like Sarah talking about how, or other people like talking about how like features need to be deployed, and like everyone's like focused on features, and Maxine's like, ah, but we have like these systems that are just needing work. We need to get these systems work. But then you cut to like the middle, and the reason why she wants those systems done is so that she can get those features, so she can work on features. Like, wait, we need to be working on features. And it's like a lot of times there's that miscommunicate or that viewpoint or, you know, disconnection, right? That like you hear devs that are saying, hey, we need to spend time working on those systems projects, we need to spend time working on those other things, and business people are going, no, we need features, and you're like, yeah, well, we need those systems because so we can build the features. Like, the, you know, we can't go and build features, is just a waste of time otherwise.
Yeah, so the vehicle kind of that I use in the Unicorn project to try to kind of teach, you know, people like Sarah in the book, you know, to the business leadership, is the five ideals. And can I just maybe run through them real quickly and kind of show how we can link each one of them to exactly what you talked about? So the first ideal is locality and simplicity. And this is really kind of a funny way of saying architecture, right? It's like, ideally, we want anyone, any team, like if they need to implement a feature, they can go to one module, one file, one app, one container, right? And just make it there, right? And so that's kind of that locality. You know, not ideal is when we have to understand every application, every module, every file, and change it, right? And, you know, that's when suddenly no one team can get that work done, right? Now you need every team, right, to agree to work on it and prioritize, schedule, sequence, and deconflict, right? And so it really is kind of the degree of which things are coupled. Another thing about locality is, you know, do teams have the authority to make decisions. If the customer asks for X, right, can we do it, right? The ideal is yes. You know, the team can just do it independent of anybody else. Not ideal is, you know, we have to get a committee meeting together, right, and make a pitch, right? And it might not be till 2 months later that, you know, we can actually make a decision. I think what's really interesting for me is that first ideal then leads to the second ideal of focus, flow, and joy. So like when you can see what you're doing, you have immediate feedback, you can actually, you know, get feedback from, you know, build systems, test systems, and customers. That allows us to have fun, right? And really enjoy our work. Whereas not ideal is every time we do a deployment, it results in catastrophe. So we really have no motivation to do it again. This is what leads to this kind of desolate existence where, you know, all our work is so disconnected from customer outcomes. And I feel like kind of my reintroduction to coding as part of my daily life. I mean, that really just it was so much informed by informed the second ideal. And the third ideal is usually what it takes to get there, right? Is, you know, when you have decades of technical debt and you have no build system and, you know, there's no one creating a safe way to get to the cloud and it's all the developers left to their own devices. I mean, it's this almost hopeless situation. And so that really is about elevating improvement of daily work, even over daily work itself, right? It's improving the systems that developers use is actually more important than building that feature. And so that's based on the Toyota production system and just realizing that greatness isn't free. I love that Satya Nadella quote. It's like, if a developer ever has to choose between a feature or dev productivity, you choose dev productivity, right? Because you now have compounding interest working in your favor as opposed to technical debt where it's, you know, it's not. Fourth ideal is psychological safety. You know, you have to make it safe to talk about problems. And Google found, and you know, we found this in the State of DevOps report. Culture was one of the top predictors of performance, but it was fun to kind of go into the Google research, and they showed through Project Oxygen, Project WeWork, that psychological safety was one of the top, was the top element of what made great teams great. You know, to what extent do members of a team feel safe to talk about problems, say what they really think without fear of blame or being made fun of or castigated? And then fifth is customer focus. Do we have leaders who really care about their silo goals? Or, you know, are they really putting the best interests of the organization at heart? And that's really inspired so much by Jeffrey Snover, technical fellow of Microsoft, who really has this wonderful construct of core versus context. Core are those, the core competencies of the organization that customers are willing to pay for. Context is everything else. And so the risk is we have to make sure context doesn't starve core, right? We have to, if customers aren't willing to pay for it, then maybe it's not something we should even be working on. So maybe that's what leads to us moving things to the cloud, because customers don't want to pay us to run big data centers because that's not what they're paying for. Hopefully those are vehicles that I'm hoping really help people have the light bulb moment of like why we can't just be working on features.
Yeah. When you were talking about actually like the first ideal locality and simplicity, and then sort of even the second ideal, I kept thinking of, again, this is probably more focused than even your ideals are, but like the development, you know, the solid principles, single responsibility, open, closed principle, like all of those principles are designed to like keep the code changes local to a small section of code so that you don't have these things spread out over everywhere, keeping it simple. And other things. One thing that I did think about was with psychological safety, like implementing culture, I think is an interesting element, because it isn't something that you can sort of ram down into people's heads. I think like a lot of people like would want to be safe, but and sort of have that. But when there's already fear, how do you like disband the fear? But then also like you can't like sort of disband the fear by implementing a new big stick that says, hey, we're gonna slap everyone's hand. You know, like I don't know how do you go about that? Do you think?
One of my favorite kind of quotes in the book was about like how fragile psychological safety is and how it's kind of this massive oversimplification to say it's you know, solely the responsibility of the leader. And it's an easy claim to make, right? Because, you know, leaders do set the cultural norms. They do kind of they should be modeling kind of the desired behaviors. But anyone who's gone through a kind of a tough postmortem, right, knows that psychological safety is very fragile. It depends on people's moods and, you know, like how their specific wounds from the past and how we felt that day. It's just kind of this magic we aspire to, but it's so easily lost. And like one person kind of screwing up, you know, everyone leaves frustrated and demoralized, right? That you know, that someone sort of violated the cultural norms. So I mean, that actually observation came from John Allspaugh, who really kind of even framed the notion of postmortems. How do we sort of create more safety where there isn't? I think a lot of it, one is, I think all of us have a responsibility to say what we really think and have a certain indifference to outcome, right? And I say that from someone who wasn't actually very good at saying what he really thought, right? And over some years, this is during my Tripwire days, I actually worked with my our VP of sales. Like, we had weekly dojo sessions where he taught me to have these fearless conversations. And in the beginning, it was basically him playing both sides of a conversation because I didn't even know like what a fearless response would look like. And I got a reputation of being one of the few people who could actually really say what, you know, he really thought. And so it is like one of those fake it till you make it. I think like whenever you're in a position of authority or responsibility, I mean, it's so important to model those desired behaviors. And I think one way is just to be very clear about, you know, when you really don't know something, just say it, right? And I think that does so much to basically say, here's kind of how I want people to act, right? Because when you don't know something, say it. Don't bluster. Don't make up something, right? Then I think also rewarding when people do courageous things, right? And I think it's those small little things that all add up.
So I don't think any organization or company would disagree with any of the ideals that you were talking about. But I think most developers are unfortunately all too familiar with companies that break every single one of those. And I don't think that they set out to create a bad work environment or set out to create a failing project. How do you think that a company gets to that point?
Yeah. So in the Phoenix Project, there was this kind of Yoda character named Eric, who kind of speaks in kind of very oblique ways. And so he has the same purpose and role in the Unicorn Project. And one of the lines that stories he tells was actually one of the biggest aha moments for me, which is like the really painting the enormity and the horrendous damage caused by technical debt. And that was a story of Nokia. Like, one of the best books, there's two amazing books that I read in the last 5 years that just blew me away. One was Team of Teams by General Stanley McChrystal. So that's the story about the Joint Task Force in Iraq in 2004, you know, fighting Al-Qaeda, right? It was a smaller, much nimbler adversary, but they were, by every measure, right, not achieving the mission of securing the safety of the citizens they were tasked to protect. It described how they were able to sort of break down kind of the silos and, you know, move decision making down to, you know, the lowest possible level. It was just this kind of amazing story. And for them to do this in a military organization with centuries of a tradition of command and control, I thought was amazing. But there was another book that I thought was as good, and that was by Risto Salasma, the chairman of Nokia. He joined the board in 2008 and took over as chairman in 2010. Yeah, I have to admit, when I first kind of started, I'm like, what can we learn from the person who oversaw the 97% decimation of market cap of Nokia? But it was amazing because he joined as a starry-eyed board member. It was the dream team of boards, right? The most valuable company in the world. And it was kind of this unflinching story of how he was very unsatisfied with his own performance because of a very domineering board chairman. But he describes in 2010 when the VP of strategy of Nokia said the build times for the Symbian OS platform was 48 hours. He said when he found that out, he felt it was like being hit in the head with a sledgehammer because he was a technical person, right? He was a founder of F-Secure. He said he knew that if it took 48 hours for any developer to know whether his or her change worked or not, then everything that we were counting on for near-term profitability and long-term viability was an illusion. And that led to them just abandoning Symbian OS and going to Windows Mobile, which wasn't so good for them either. But that was a better bet than staying on Symbian OS, right? Where the feedback times were so abysmal that he was saying, if I had known that 2 years ago, right, we should have yanked the cord immediately. So to me, it just says that that is kind of the level of sophistication we need from business leadership. And, you know, you take a look at Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, you know, they all went through something like that. LinkedIn, eBay, where they couldn't deliver features anymore. And they all went through a feature freeze where they said, it's become so dangerous to deploy code, we can't deploy any longer. Microsoft went through the famous security stand down in 2004 and all managed to figure out how to pay down technical debt to make it safe for developers to be productive again. And so I think, you know, that's that more than anything, I'm hoping the book will teach business leaders and product owners about in terms of how do you properly allow developers to create greatness around them.
If you're a developer looking for a job, how can you recognize that a company exhibits the ideals? I mean, you get very little during an interview, and I mean, let's face it, everything you see from the outside is a shop window. It's all fake. So is there any way that you can tell that a company does exhibit the ideals?
Oh man, what a great question. Yeah, in fact, let me go through each one of them and just kind of give you some sample questions. By the way, that is a phenomenal question. First idea of locale and simplicity. For describe a major class of feature and like how many teams are required to implement it. Was it one team or was it 40 teams? and it's not only developer teams, it's like name all the test teams and infrastructure teams and security teams. So that's a great one. In the Unicorn project, it's like, if I want to get something done, how many people do I need to take to lunch? Is it the Amazon ideal of two pizzas, or am I having to buy 300 people lunch? Right. Second ideal is like, how happy are you in your work? What are you on a weekly basis? In the last couple of weeks, could you name an achievement that you were most proud of? Right? Hopefully, it was like shipping a great feature that you felt proud of, or burying some technical debt. Something. Or was it? I don't have much done in the last month that I'm very proud of. That. How happy are people? Right. I think we know from the State of DevOps research that engagement, satisfaction, employee net promoter score are very tightly correlated with all the things we've talked about. Improvement of daily work. Like, what is the philosophy this organization has around retiring tech debt? How do you balance feature work versus tech debt? Give me an example of some tech debt that you were proud of retiring. That would be a great one. Psychological safety. To what extent do people feel safe saying what they really think? Give me examples of what leadership has done to demonstrate that they care about, reinforcing that norm. And then customer focus. Yeah, it's what are the top goals of the organization? Just ask a couple of people that and see, how consistent that is. And I think Microsoft has done so well in under the Satya regime versus the Balm regime is like everyone knows what the goal is, right? Cloud and mobility, mobile and cloud, right? Whereas I think that's just an amazing testament of how you change the culture of 6,000 technologists.
I've found that I must not be asking some of these questions for the types of projects that I end up on from time to time.
But when you say that, it's just so interesting because it is that environment, that system actually predicts to what degrees developers are productive more than like the developer's skill. So isn't it, it's just that when you ask that question, Clayton, it's just kind of like this, my own sort of sledgehammer in the forehead. It's like, wow, we ask about developer skills, but like really the more important questions are like the systems that surround the developer, right?
Yeah, and with that, I've worked in a variety of different environments, small companies, sixth employee at one company. I've been in very large companies as well. So I've run the gamut of I have the keys to the kingdom and I can right click and publish to production. Maybe production is the only environment. And I've also been in lockdown environments where I can't install anything on my own laptop. But it seems like there's still a struggle in a variety of different organizations to sell DevOps to an organization, to sell the processes and procedures to automate a lot of the mundane tasks out there. So how do we go about better selling DevOps to organizations?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so that was actually the motivation for the State of DevOps report. So, I've had the privilege of working with Dr. Nicole Forsgren and Jez Humble on, the largest cross-population study of high performance look like and what are the behaviors and architectural practices, technical practices that create high performance. You know, incidentally, the cross-population study is the instrument that was used to create the link between smoking and early morbidity. So it's a very kind of a it's a great, well-accepted tool in the social sciences. So I think that's kind of how you appeal to the, is it the left brain? Yeah, the left brain, right? We love numbers, right? So we know that high performers are massively outperforming their peers. They have higher deployment frequencies, shorter deployment lead times, higher chain success rates, lower mean time to repair, right? And there's just incredible decisive evidence to show that's the case. But I think, yeah, to your point, like, does that alone sell DevOps? And I think it's often insufficient in my experience. And I think that's kind of the role of the Unicorn Project, to really kind of show for a fictitious organization how screwed up things are. Right? It's kind of a disarming way to say, like in a book club, hey, here's this kind of really messed up organization. And I'm not saying that's us, right? But do we have any of these problems? And I think what will kind of hopefully get revealed is, you know, these kind of technical practices, architectural problems, and to your point of environments, right? It, to me, it's always interesting, right? Kind of in the old days, we had, if we had, 100 production servers, we might have 10 test environments and, one staging environment. And we now know kind of what we really want, right, to kind of get these kind of massive improvements in performance is that if we have 100 production servers, we should probably have 1,000 pre-production servers, right? And every developer with probably a production-like server running inside of a container on their laptop, which is like this kind of complete inversion of the way we thought we should, the ratios are all now totally flipped. So that's kind of one of my aspirations for the Unicorn Project, is just to, very much like the Phoenix Project, just when people read the book and they say, holy cow, like these problems sound familiar. And like, this might be happening to us. And so that would be one of the things that would just be the most joyful outcome for me out of the book.
Is that why you sort of went with a novel form to sort of make that ability for people to sort of convey, hey, here's a situation and envision themselves in it, as opposed to having to sort of go through more of a, obviously you do have the DevOps handbook, but more of a sort of technical manual or.
Yeah, for sure. I think it has been demonstrated over and over that kind of the stories are one of the best mechanisms to sort of get mirror neurons to fire in someone else. And the goal was certainly had that effect in lean manufacturing, the Phoenix Project. I remember when I was reading a book called Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni. I still remember when reading it, I was on a plane and it was all about sort of like dysfunctional teams. And it was about a startup where it was with kind of some domineering executives and a CTO who couldn't speak his mind enough. And I'm reading this book, and I had to close it a couple of times. And I actually felt like when you are so stressed out, you might even be sweating. it was just so stressful to read. And just having to force myself to keep reading. I mean, that's kind of the reaction we hope for as storytellers, right? Is when you can kind of evoke, maybe not to that extent, but we don't want to traumatize or hurt anyone. But just be able to convey what badness looks like and show what the reward looks like, if we can solve the problems.
Do you have any resources that you might recommend to people who want to learn more about the Unicorn Project or DevOps or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. What a great question. My editor thinks I'm very weird in this way, but one of my favorite parts of writing books is the bibliographies. must come from being a not having been an academic. Maybe it's an aspiration that I feel like I need to compensate for. But I love citations. I think the DevOps handbook, it costs like $15,000 to do the fact checking of the citations. But so I was not allowed to do that for the Unicorn Project, but I do have a list of references. That's about 4 pages. I'll send you a link that you can put into the show notes I think kind of really define the corpus of people who are, chapter by chapter, people who are interested in the specific topics. Here's a list of, 5 to 10 videos, books, talks, tweets that inspired certain things. If I had to list 5 books off the top of my head, I mentioned 2 of them. Team of Teams by General Stanley McChrystal, Transforming Nokia by Risto Salasma, you know, regardless of what functional programming language, you know, you choose, whether it's F-sharp or Haskell or Clojure, I think as developers, there's something there that really encourages a better way of thinking that sort of forces the decoupling of things. There's actually another podcast that's all about, by three people. One's like an expert in functional programming. One's kind of a someone with a couple years experience, and one's a novice. And it was just great. Just the way they teach the concepts, just having a novice in the audience, it just was amazing. I always felt like that novice was always asking questions that was in my head. In fact, the novice was actually answering the questions before I could formulate the answers. I would have to like rewind a couple times and like, what? Like, just explain that again. And then another book called Project to Product, all about like, how do we get away from project management thinking to product oriented thinking that just solves, that in and of itself solves so much of the problems of how we build software.
So to kind of close in a different direction, one of the things we have all of our guests come on is to ask them about if they would speak to the audience members or the listeners that are just getting started or are maybe trying to like level up in their career. Do you have any like specific words of wisdom or things that you would say to them?
Yeah, I love that part. Here's the advice I would give is. There's this saying, you're only as good as the top five people you hang out with. And I love that. There was a certain point in my career where when I first heard that, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm hanging around. Everyone I hang out with are people dumber than me. maybe to exaggerate slightly. But I mean, that really forced me to, I think, have an unflinching exercise to sit down. I was like, all right, what do I want to be good at? And who do I need to be hanging out with? And what I've learned is that it's so easy these days, right? I mean, you have amazing podcasts. You can see people are so accessible on Twitter. So you can actually aim high. But I think one of my favorite things to do that, you know, you can almost have 100% success rate is find someone that you work with and ask to follow them around for a day. So the notion of shadowing, I would encourage you to do that like a couple times a year, right? So if you're an engineer, follow a senior engineer around, someone who's kind of more in an architecture role, and just see what they see. Pair with someone with more experience than you so that you're doing daily work together, and maybe even do shadow people completely outside the technology organization, or better yet, a customer that is actually who you know your products or services are intended to serve. And I can promise you that will always be an eye-opening experience. And you know, if you find problems that you can help with, you know, you will earn their eternal gratitude. And yeah, so that's something I wish I had done much earlier in my career. And if for anyone who feels intimidated or afraid that someone will say no, I would just say your odds of people saying no to that are very, very low. And if you can also, as a result of that, offer to help them with things that you see them struggling with, right? They will be grateful for you to have followed them around and grateful for any help that you can offer them.
How about if people want to either contact you or follow you? Is there some social media outlets that would be the best ways to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. The best way is probably on Twitter. You can DM me. I'm at RealGeneKim. So you can, whether in a DM or in a public tweet, absolutely. And you can also email me at GeneK@itrevolution.com.
And lastly, do you have any upcoming speaking engagements that you might like to sort of call out or mention?
Oh, gosh. None planned. I'm going to be doing the Yao speaking series in Australia next week. And I probably have some stuff early next year. But yeah, I can tell you, as you probably can resonate with kind of going through any sort of product launch, book launch, my planning horizon is measured in hours, not days or weeks.
Very cool.
Thanks, Gene. Really appreciate you coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, John, and Clayton, thank you for having me on. And it's great to be on the podcast after being a fan of so many of the episodes. So thank you so much.
That was Gene Kim. Gene is a multiple award-winning CTO, researcher, and author, and has been studying high-performing technology organizations since 1999. He has authored many great books, including The Unicorn Project, The Phoenix Project, and The DevOps Handbook. He currently lives in Portland, Oregon, with his wife and family.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.